The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is pleased to present The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time by Will Durant. This book was compiled and edited by John Little, and the reader is John Little. It is complete and unabridged.
Introduction. In 1968, shortly after winning the Pulitzer Prize for Literature, Will Durant and his wife Ariel consented to a television interview to be conducted in their home in Los Angeles, California. The interviewer, who fancied himself something of an intellectual, posed to Durant the following question. If I were to ask you to name the person who has most influenced our century, the 20th century, would it be Karl Marx? Durant paused for a moment and then replied, "Well, if you use the word in its largest sense, we would have to give the greatest share of influence to the technical inventors, to men like Edison. Doubtless the development of electricity has transformed the world even more than any Marxian propaganda. Then, if you think in terms of ideas, I think the influence of Darwin is still greater than the influence of Marx, but in a different field. The basic phenomenon of our time is not communism, it's the decline of religious belief, which has all sorts of effects on morals and even on politics, because religion has been a tool of politics. But today in Europe, it ceases to be a tool. It has very little influence in determining political decisions, whereas 500 years ago, the Pope was superior in influence to any civil ruler on earth." Later, during the same interview, the interviewer turned to his subject and asked, "Dr. Durant, of all the characters populating the story of civilization, whom would you have most liked to have known?" Durant contemplated the question seriously and then, poker-faced, replied, "Madame de Pompadour." The interviewer was dumbfounded. "Why is that?" he asked. A twinkle came to Durant's eyes as he answered, "Well, she was beautiful, she was charming, she was luscious. What else do you want?" I cite these two anecdotes not simply to reveal Durant's views on the influence of inventors and biologists on human history, nor even his tendency to use wit to disarm journalists who took themselves or their vocations too seriously. He once noted that humor is akin to philosophy, for they are both viewpoints born of a large perspective of life. But rather to show that his opinion on assessing the significance of individuals and events from human history was something that was constantly sought after, sometimes twice in the same interview. It is entirely understandable that Durant should find himself asked to answer such questions. Any time a man spends over half a century researching and writing an 11-volume integral history of civilization, it is natural that people are going to want to know what conclusions he has drawn from the enterprise, to know what eras, individuals, and achievements stood out in his mind as being the greatest or most significant. Who, for example, would Durant rate on his roll of honor of human thought as the greatest thinkers in human history? Who would he rate as the truly great poets, the ones that pluck notes upon heartstrings that continue to resonate hundreds and thousands of years after their passing? And what would be the absolute best books one should read in order to receive a meaningful and useful education? Over the course of Durant's career, he responded to the increasing public demand for such qualified assessments by putting pen to paper and crafting a series of essays containing his personal ranking of the 10 greatest thinkers, the 10 greatest poets, the 100 best books for an education, the 10 peaks of human progress, and 12 vital dates in world history. Certain of these essays were published in periodicals, others were presented as lectures to standing room only attendees. However, unless you happened to purchase those magazines, or were fortunate enough to attend one of those lectures, it would not have been possible to learn of his conclusions in these matters. Fortunately, all of these essays have been brought together in The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time. To formulate a ranking system and then apply it to such a broad array of human achievement is a difficult undertaking, to be sure, but Durant, as always, succeeds brilliantly. He not only presents compelling evidence for his selections, but also stimulates the reader to form his or her own opinions and to look beyond immediate surroundings and present culture and into a timeless realm, which he called the country of the mind, a sort of cerebral retirement home, wherein the heroes of our species dwell after having served their time and purpose in the respective eras, and where to be human is something to be lauded. Indeed, the title of the first chapter of this book serves to frame its very thesis, A Shameless Worship of Heroes. The philosophy that resonates from the pages of all of Durant's books, but most particularly in the greatest minds and ideas of all time, is unabashedly pro-human, and serves to underscore the splendor of our intellectual and artistic heritage. In fact, Durant was known as the gentle philosopher and the radical saint, as he always sought to report on the positive achievements in human events and history. In a sentence, Durant chose to illuminate with his pen the mountain peaks of greatness in our species' history. The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time is a book containing the absolute best of our heritage, passed on for the edification and benefit of future generations. Replete with Durant's renowned erudition, wit, and unique ability to explain the profoundest of events and ideas in simple and exciting terms, it is a book that serves both as a wonderful introduction to the writings of Will Durant and as a summing up, a quantification of genius, a travel guide to the must-see stops in the landscape of human history. In many respects, this book is a wonderful and logical companion volume to Durant's Heroes of History. Most notably, whereas Heroes of History is an overview of over 100 centuries of human achievement, The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time provides Durant's personal assessment of it. Moreover, The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time contains profiles of three individuals, Darwin, Keats, and Whitman, that had been intended for inclusion in the Heroes of History book, but owing to a series of personal calamities, culminating in Durant's death in 1981, were omitted from the text. Indeed, the intended final two chapters of Heroes, Durant's last book, would never be composed. Through prose that rises at times to the heights of poetry, The Greatest Minds and Ideas of All Time is an extension of Durant's long-standing invitation to enter the world of the best of the best, and a means by which one can come to recognize and befriend genius. The dividends from such an enterprise are many, for as Durant once noted, "We cannot live long in that celestial realm of all genius without becoming a little finer than we were. And though we shall not find there the poignant delirium of youth, we shall know a lasting, gentle happiness, a profound delight, which time cannot take from us until it takes all." Chapter 1. A Shameless Worship of Heroes. Of the many ideals which in youth gave life a meaning and radiance missing from the chilly perspectives of middle age, one at least has remained with me as bright and satisfying as ever before, the shameless worship of heroes. In an age that would level everything and reverence nothing, I take my stand with Victorian Carlyle and light my candles like Mirandola before Plato's image at the shrines of great men. I say shameless, for I know how unfashionable it is now to acknowledge in life or history any genius loftier than ourselves. Our democratic dogma has leveled not only all voters, but all leaders. We delight to show that living geniuses are only mediocrities, and that dead ones are myths. If we may believe historian H.G. Wells, Caesar was a numbskull and Napoleon a fool. Since it is contrary to good manners to exalt ourselves, we achieve the same result by slyly indicating how inferior are the great men of the earth. In some of us, perhaps, it is a noble and merciless asceticism, which would root out of our hearts the last vestige of worship and adoration, lest the old god should return and terrify us again. For my part, I cling to this final religion, and discover in it a content and stimulus more lasting than came from the devotional ecstasies of youth. How natural it seemed to greet the great Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore by that title which so long had been given him by his countrymen, Guru Deva, revered master. For why should we stand reverent before waterfalls and mountaintops, or a summer moon on a quiet sea, and not before the highest miracle of all, a man who is both great and good? So many of us are mere talents, clever children in the play of life, that when genius stands in our presence we can only bow down before it as an act of God, a continuance of creation. Such men are the very lifeblood of history, to which politics and industry are but frame and bones. Part cause of the dry scholasticism from which we were suffering when James Harvey Robinson summoned us to humanize our knowledge was a conception of history as an impersonal flow of figures and facts in which genius played so inessential a role that histories prided themselves upon ignoring them. It was to Karl Marx above all that this theory of history was due. It was bound up with a view of life that distrusted the exceptional man, envied superior talent, and exalted the humble as the inheritors of the earth. In the end, men began to write history as if it had never been lived at all, as if no drama had ever walked through it, no comedies or tragedies of struggling or frustrated men. The vivid narratives of Gibbon and Taine gave way to ash heaps of irrelevant erudition, in which every fact was correct, documented, and dead. No, the real history of man is not in prices and wages, nor in elections and battles, nor in the even tenor of the common man. It is in the lasting contributions made by geniuses to the sum of human civilization and culture. The history of France is not, if one may say it with all courtesy, the history of the French people, the history of those nameless men and women who tilled the soil, cobbled the shoes, cut the cloth, and peddled the goods, for these things have been done everywhere and always. The history of France is the record of her exceptional men and women, her inventors, scientists, statesmen, poets, artists, musicians, philosophers, and saints, and of the additions which they made to the technology and wisdom, the artistry and decency, of their people and mankind. And so with every country, so with the world. Its history is properly the history of its great men. What are the rest of us but willing brick and mortar in their hands, that they may make a race a little finer than ourselves? Therefore, I see history not as a dreary scene of politics and carnage, but as the struggle of man through genius with the obdurate inertia of matter and the baffling mystery of mind, the struggle to understand, control, and remake himself and the world. I see men standing on the edge of knowledge and holding the light a little farther ahead, men carving marble into forms ennobling men, men molding peoples into better instruments of greatness, men making a language of music and music out of language, men dreaming of finer lives and living them. Here is a process of creation more vivid than in any myth, a godliness more real than in any creed. To contemplate such men, to insinuate ourselves through study into some modest discipleship to them, to watch them at their work and warm ourselves at the fire that consumes them, this is to recapture some of the thrill that youth gave us when we thought, at the altar or in the confessional, that we were touching or hearing God. In that dreamy youth, we believed that life was evil, and that only death could usher us into paradise. We were wrong. Even now, while we live, we may enter it. Every great book, every work of revealing art, every record of a devoted life is a call and an open sesame to the Elysian fields. Too soon we extinguish the flame of our hope and our reverence. Let us change the icons and light the candles again. Chapter 2. The 10 Greatest Thinkers. What is thought? It baffles description because it includes everything through which it might be defined. It is the most immediate fact that we know, and the last mystery of our being. All other things come to us as its forms, and all human achievements find in it their source and their goal. Its appearance is the great turning point in the drama of evolution. When did the miracle begin? Perhaps when the great surges of ice came down relentlessly from the pole, chilling the air, destroying vegetation almost everywhere, eliminating countless species of helpless and unadaptable animals, and pushing a few survivors into a narrow tropical belt, where for generations they clung to the equator, waiting for the wrath of the north to melt. Probably it was in those critical days, when all the old and wonted ways of life were nullified by the invading ice, and inherited or traditional patterns of behavior found no success in an environment where everything was altered, that animals with comparatively complete but inflexible instinctive equipment were weeded out because they could not change within to meet the change outside, while the animal we call man, dowered with a precarious plasticity, learned and rose to an unquestioned supremacy over all the species of the forest and the field. It was on some such life-and-death emergency as this, presumably, that human reasoning began. That same incompleteness and adaptability of native reactions which we see today in the infant, which makes it so inferior to a newborn animal but leaves it in recompense the possibility of learning, that same plasticity saved man and the higher mammals, while powerful organisms like the mammoth and the mastodon, that had prowled about hitherto supreme, succumbed to the icy change and became mere sport for paleontological curiosity. They shivered and passed away, while man, puny man, remained. Thought and invention began. The bewilderment of baffled instinct begot the first timid hypotheses, the first tentative putting together of two and two, the first generalizations, the first painful studies of similarities of quality and regularities of sequence, the first adaptation of things learned to situations so novel that reactions instinctive and immediate broke down in utter failure. It was then that certain instincts of action evolved into modes of thought and instruments of intelligence. What had been watchful waiting or stalking a prey became attention. Fear and flight became caution and deliberation. Pugnacity and assault became curiosity and analysis. Manipulation became experiment. The animal stood up erect and became man, slave still to a thousand circumstances, timidly brave before countless perils, but in his precarious way destined henceforth to be lord of the earth. The Adventure of Human Reason. From that obscure age to our own place and time, the history of civilization has been the adventure of human reason. At every step on the stairway of progress, it was thought that lifted us, slowly and tentatively, to a larger power and a higher life. If ideas do not determine history, inventions do, and inventions are determined by ideas. Certainly it is desire, the restlessness of our insatiable wants, that agitates us into thinking. But however motivated or inspired, it is thought that finds a way. We need not settle, then, the ancient dispute between those hero worshippers like Carlyle and Nietzsche, who interpret history in terms of great men, and those hero scorners who, like Spencer and Marx, see only economic causes behind historical events. We may be sure that no pressure of economic circumstance would have ever sufficed to advance mankind if the illuminating spark of thought had not intervened. Perhaps Tard and James were right, and all history is a succession of inventions made by genius and turned into conventions by the people, a series of initiatives taken by adventurous leaders and spread among the masses of mankind by the waves of imitation. There is no doubt that at the beginning and summit of every age, some heroic genius stands, the voice and index of his time, the inheritor and interpreter of the past, the guide and pioneer into the future. If we could find in each epoch of unfolding civilization the representative and dominating figure in its thought, we should have a living panorama of our history. But as we face the task of selecting these persons of the drama, about whom the play revolves, a dozen difficulties daunt us. What shall be our test of greatness? How, in the roster of human genius, shall we know whom to omit and whom to name? The criteria. Well, we shall be ruthless and dogmatic here, and though it break our hearts, we shall admit no hero to our list whose thought, however subtle or profound, has not had an enduring influence upon mankind. This must be our supreme test. We shall try to take account of the originality and scope, the veracity and depth of each thinker's thought. But what we must bear in mind, above all, is the extent and persistence of his influence upon the lives and minds of men. Only so can we control, in some measure, our personal prejudices, and arrive at some moderate impartiality in our choice. And now, how shall we define a thinker? Presumably, the word will embrace philosophers and scientists. But only these? Shall we include men like Euripides, or Lucretius, or Dante, or Leonardo, or Shakespeare, or Goethe? No, we shall bow humbly to such great names and class them, despite the reach and fathom of their thought, as only secondarily thinkers, as artists, first and above all. Shall we include such immensely influential leaders as Jesus or Buddha or Augustine or Luther? No, these founders and renewers of religion would overlap our term. It was not thought or reason, but feeling and noble passion, a mystic vision and an incorrigible faith that made them, from their little foot of earth, move the world. Shall we admit into our council of ten those great men of action, whose names ring down the corridor of history, men like Pericles, or Alexander, or Caesar, or Charlemagne, or Cromwell, or Napoleon, or Lincoln? No. If we spread the word thinker to catch such heroes in its net, we shall deprive it of its distinctive meaning, and shall fail to catch the significance of thought. We must embrace within it philosophers and scientists alone. We shall seek for those men who, by their thinking, rather than by their action or their passion, have most influenced mankind. We shall search for them in the quiet places of the world, far from the madding crowd, in those obscure corners where great thoughts came to them, quote, as on dove's feet, close quote, and where for a moment they saw, as in a transfiguration, the countenance of truth. Who, then, shall be first? Number 1. Confucius. At once our doubts and quarrels begin. By what canon shall we include Confucius and omit Buddha and Christ? By this alone, that he was a moral philosopher rather than a preacher of religious faith, that his call to the noble life was based upon secular motives rather than upon supernatural considerations, that he far more resembles Socrates than Jesus. Born in 552 BC in an age of confusion, in which the old power and glory of China had passed into feudal disintegration and factional strife, Kung Futsa undertook to restore health and order to his country. How? Let him speak. The illustrious ancients, when they wished to make clear and to propagate the highest virtues in the world, put their states in proper order. Before putting their states in proper order, they regulated their families. Before regulating their families, they cultivated their own selves. Before cultivating their own selves, they perfected their souls. Before perfecting their souls, they tried to be sincere in their thoughts. Before trying to be sincere in their thoughts, they extended to the utmost their knowledge. Such investigation of knowledge lay in the investigation of things, and in seeing them as they really were. When things were thus investigated, knowledge became complete. When knowledge was complete, their thoughts became sincere. When their thoughts were sincere, their souls became perfect. When their souls were perfect, their own selves became cultivated. When their selves were cultivated, their families became regulated. When their families were regulated, their states came to be put into proper order. When their states were in proper order, then the whole world became peaceful and happy. Here is a sound moral and political philosophy within the compass of a paragraph. It was a highly conservative system. It exalted manners and etiquette and scorned democracy. Despite its clear enunciation of the golden rule, it was nearer to Stoicism than to Christianity. A pupil, having asked him, "Should one return good for evil?" Confucius replied, quote, "With what then will you recompense kindness? Return good for good, and for evil, justice." Close quote. He did not believe that all men were equal. It seemed to him that intelligence was not a universal gift. As his pupil Mencius put it, "That whereby man differs from the lower animals is little. Most people throw it away." The greatest fortune of a people would be to keep ignorant persons from public office and secure their wisest men to rule them. A great city, Chengdu, took him at his word and made him magistrate. A marvelous reformation, we are told, ensued in the manners of the people. There was an end of crime. Dishonesty and dissoluteness hid their heads. Loyalty and good faith became the characteristic of the men, chastity and docility of the women. It is too good to be true, and probably it did not last very long. But even in his lifetime, Confucius's followers understood his greatness and foresaw the timeless influence he was to have in molding the courtesy and poise and placid wisdom of the Chinese. His disciples buried him with great pomp. A multitude of them built huts near his grave and remained there, mourning as for a father, for nearly 3 years. When all the others were gone, Tsze Kung, who had loved him beyond the rest, continued by the grave for 3 years more alone. Number 2. Plato. And now we are faced with new problems. Whole civilizations confront us in which we can find no dominating name, no powerful secular personality voicing and forming his people with thought. It is so in India and among the Jews, and among the nomad races of Asia Minor's Fertile Crescent. We have a Buddha, an Isaiah, a Jesus, and a Muhammad, but we have no world scientist, no world philosopher. And in another case, perhaps the most lasting and marvelous civilization the world has ever known, we have 100 pharaohs and innumerable relics of a varied art, but no name stands out as that of one who brought the past into the perspective of wisdom and stamped his influence upon the intellectual development of his nation. We have to pass respectfully by these peoples and these centuries and consider the glory of Periclean Greece. Why do we love Plato? Because Plato himself was a lover, lover of comrades, lover of the intoxication of dialectical revelry, passionate seeker of the elusive reality behind thoughts and things. We love him for his unstinted energy, for the wild nomadic play of his fancy, for the joy which he found in life and all its unredeemed and adventurous complexity. We love him because he was alive every minute of his life and never ceased to grow. Such a man can be forgiven for whatever errors he has made. We love him because of his high passion for social reconstruction through intelligent control, because he retained throughout his 80 years that zeal for human improvement, which is for most of us the passing luxury of youth, because he conceived philosophy as an instrument not merely for the interpretation, but for the remolding of the world. We love him because he worshipped beauty as well as truth, and gave to ideas the living movement of drama, and clothed them in all the radiance of art. Here, in the Republic and the Dialogues, is such a riotous play of the creative imagination as might have made a Shakespeare. Here is imagery squandered with lordly abandon. Here is humor such as one misses in our ponderous modern philosophers. Here is no system, but all systems. Here is one abounding fountainhead of European thought. Here is prose as strong and beautiful as the great temples where Greek joy disported itself in marble. Here, literary prose is born, and born adult. Plato, then, must be our second name. But we shall have to defend him against a very reasonable challenge. What of old Socrates, almost the father and surely the greatest martyr of philosophy? It will seem ridiculous to omit him from a list which will include heroes not half so great as he. The reader must not be shocked to learn that Socrates is half a myth and only half a man. A learned Frenchman, Monsieur Dupré, in La Légende Socratique, has reduced the noble gadfly to the misty historical status of Achilles, Oedipus, Romulus, and Siegfried. No doubt, when we are dead, some careful and conscientious scholar will prove that we never existed. But we may be certain that in good measure Socrates owes his fame as a philosopher to the creative imagination of Plato, who used the magnificent idler as the mouthpiece of his views. How much of Plato's Socrates was Socrates, and how much of it was Plato, we shall probably never know. Let us take Plato as implying both. His dialogues are among the most precious possessions of mankind. Here, for the first time, philosophy took form, and by the very exuberance of youth, achieved a perfection unrivaled in after days. Do you wish to hear noble discourse of love and friendship? Read the Lysis, the Charmides, and the Phaedrus. Would you know what a great and tender soul, the Platonic Socrates, thought of another life? Read the Phaedo, whose final pages are one of the peaks in the history of prose. Are you interested in the puzzles of the mind, in the mystery of knowledge? Read the Parmenides and the Theaetetus. Are you interested in anything? Read the Republic. Here you shall find metaphysics, theology, ethics, psychology, theory of education, theory of statesmanship, theory of art. Here you shall find feminism and birth control, communism and socialism with all their virtues and their difficulties, eugenics and libertarian education, aristocracy and democracy, vitalism and psychoanalysis. What shall you not find here? No wonder Emerson awarded to the Republic the words which the occasionally pious Omar had written of the Koran. Quote, "Burn the libraries, for their value is in this book." Close quote. As to Plato's influence, how can we doubt? Consider the academy which he founded, the first and longest lived of the universities of the world. Consider the perpetual revival of Plato's philosophy from the Neoplatonists of Alexandria to the Cambridge Platonists of England. Consider the permeation of Christian theology with Platonic thought and symbolism, and the dominance of Plato in the culture of the earlier Middle Ages. Consider the enthusiastic Platonism of the Renaissance, when Lorenzo's Table recaptured some of the glory of the Symposium, and Pico della Mirandola burned candles devoutly before the master's image. Consider that at this moment, in 100 countries and 1,000 cities, 100,000 students, young and old, are absorbed in the Republic or the Dialogues, are being slowly and gratefully molded into a sensitive wisdom by the ardor and subtlety of Plato. Here is an immortality of the soul, which makes almost insignificant the passing of the flesh. Number 3. Aristotle. All the world would agree that Aristotle must be in our list. The Middle Ages called him the philosopher, as if to say that he embodied the type at the summit of its perfection. It is not that we love him. The text he has left behind him expound so monotonously a passionless moderation that after feeling the radiance of Plato, we freeze at the touch of the Stagirite's tempered mind. But it is unfair to rate him by his books. We know now that they were but hasty notes made sometimes by himself, sometimes by his students, for the guidance or remembrance of his lectures. It would be absurd to judge him by comparing these technical fragments with the vivid dialogues through which Plato won for the first time a public audience for philosophy. But let us once overcome this barrier of scholastic terminology and scornfully concentrated thought, and we shall find ourselves in the presence of an intellect of almost unbelievable depth and range. Here is a circumnavigation of the globe such as no mind has accomplished since. Here, every problem in science and philosophy has its consideration, its illumination, and a defensible solution. Here, knowledge is brought together as if through 1,000 spies, and coordinated into a united vision of the world. Here, the phraseology of philosophy is born, and today it is hardly possible to think without using the mintage of Aristotle's brain. Here is wisdom, calm, temperate, and well-nigh complete, as of a limitless intelligence majestically overspreading life. Here are new sciences, founded with almost casual ease, as if the supreme creations of the human intellect were but the recreations of a philosopher. Here it is that biology appears, and embryology, and logic. Not that no man had ever thought of these matters before, but that none had controlled his thinking with patient observation, careful experiment, and systematic formulation of results. Barring astronomy and medicine, the history of science begins with the encyclopedic labors of the tireless Stagirite.